Good afternoon, ladies and gentlemen, and thank you very much for coming to the fourth of our Stand on the Shoulders of Giants talks. These talks are showcasing great Oxford academics talking about their passion for their subject, and today I'm proud to introduce Danny Dorling. Danny is the Harvard Mackinder Professor of Geography at the University of Oxford. He's published more than a dozen books with many colleagues on issues related to social inequalities in Britain. And his particular interests are issues of housing, health, employment, education and poverty. His most recent book, Inequality and the 1%, argues that inequality is the biggest threat humanity faces. So today he's going to speak on the topic, what does studying inequality teach us, for 20, 25 minutes. Then there'll be about 10 minutes for you to join the discussion, ask him some questions, and after which Danny will be available to sign copies of his books. So I hope you'll join me in welcoming Danny Dorling.
Great. Thanks very much for coming. I may keep it down to about 15 minutes so we can do more questions and so on, because I suspect you'll get a bit bored with my monologue on this. The thing I've been asked to talk about is what's so good about studying inequality, why study inequality. I have a suspicion that studying inequality now might be a bit like it felt to study things like population growth around about 1968, when population growth was completely out of control. You didn't know what was going to happen, and popular books were written about how we were all going to die in famines that sold very, very well. Because around about 1968, 1971, we were on a cusp. We didn't know it, but our annual population growth had got up to 2% a year in the world. If that had carried on for another couple of centuries, the entire planet would be covered in human beings and it would all be over. And it's very similar today when it comes to inequality. Credit Suisse released a report yesterday about world wealth, where they claimed that the richest 1% in the world, who last year had about 41% of all the wealth in the world, this year had 48% of all the wealth in the world. 7% rise in just 12 months. Run that one forward about 7 years, and the best off 1% have everything. So what you can tell from that is that it isn't going to continue like this. It can't continue like this. There just isn't enough money to make that possible. And the chances that we are very near a peak of something extreme are pretty high, because the statistics are currently so incredible. What Credit Suisse say in their report is that there will be a 40% increase in global wealth in just the next 5 years. Most of that going to the very rich. But you've got to think, well, how do you create a 40% increase in global wealth? Are we going to make that much more of things? And so it's an interesting time to look at inequality in the sense of what is actually happening. The American top 1% figure has hit a peak. It's well over 20%. It's never been that high before. Maybe in the Great Gatsby years for a short amount of time, but everything is looking pretty extreme. The second reason for studying inequality, apart from the fact that the numbers are just suggesting you really ought to, is that it's actually quite a good way of making yourself fairly happy, which may sound odd, but as soon as you begin to look at the wealth or income distributions or other life chance distributions, you quickly become to realise just where you personally are. It's very hard to feel particularly angry about your personal position once you get an idea about what the average is in this country or what the average is in the world and how things are moving apart, and how upset people are who've got a lot more than you. You'll be really shocked, or you may know, to find how many people in the top 1% in Britain, that's people with an income of over £160,000 a year, don't think they get that much and find it hard to get by. And they're not faking it. They really do have these feelings, because things like house prices have gone so high for them. Inequality ends up permeating lots and lots of different subjects. The key event that brought it to the fore in this country was the publication of a book called The Spirit Level. Now, how many of you have read The Spirit Level? Okay, you've got a few. Spirit Level, the hardback, was released in 2009, the paperback in 2010, and it was actually a story of discovery. The two authors of the book had done a little paper in a very obscure journal looking at just over a dozen social indicators, things like how many people are imprisoned in different societies, how well people do at school, levels of mental illness. And after they did the first three or four or five of these, they kept on finding a very similar relationship. For rich countries, and this is the important thing, it's only for rich countries, they were finding a fairly linear or even a log linear relationship between the degree of inequality in those countries and the measure of overall social harm. Things like how obese people were. Now, there's a danger when you find this, that you begin to create inequality as a kind of explanation of everything. And it's not an explanation of everything, but it seems a pretty important underlying factor in many things going wrong, often for very different reasons. And inequality may be a fairly good measure of when a society becomes dysfunctional, becomes badly ruled in various ways. It's also a problem of riches. Until the last 30 years, we hadn't got to the point where these relationships could come out. Up until about 30 years ago, to make it very simple, if your country became richer, on average, you did better. And so it's only been in the last few decades that this relationship has been so clear to see. You can look at historical trends in inequality to get an idea of where we are, and it can calm you down about worrying about politics. You can get very sort of upset about, is the Labour Party going to win? What happens if the Conservative Party wins in this country? If you take a long view of the inequality curve, it's extremely hard to actually see the effects of different parties taking power, and you see long-term patterns emerge. So in this country, we were most unequal around about 1913. That was the peak of inequality. Our best off 1% had about 20% of all income, and that fell pretty steadily all the way from then through to the 1970s. Half the fall was before the Second World War, so it wasn't just about that war. And it fell to a low point when I was a child in this city of about the best off 1% having just six times the average income, just four times after tax. And for people who are younger than me, they find it very hard to believe that that was the situation. Also that many things actually worked pretty well then. But all the rich countries of the world came down together. There were slight and subtle differences. The Americans waited until World War II and then plummeted down to become more equal. But they all became more equal. It's since 1978, that you've had a fanning out. Some countries have seen huge increases in inequality, like the USA and like us. Other countries like Switzerland and the Netherlands have seen hardly any increases or even a decrease. So you now have this great variety between countries that lets you do these international comparisons to say what is the possible effects. And I'll go through about five of the effects and then I'll stop and get you to query me about why does this matter. The first effect really is on children. What happens to children when they're brought up in more unequal societies as opposed to children who are brought up in more equal societies? Now, you get a huge amount of research. There are more educational researchers in social sciences in this country than there are in any other social science. So a huge amount of work is done on what works and what doesn't work in education. But if you take a pretty simple measure, not a measure that's taken at the time of an exam, because we're now very good at getting kids to do very well on the day of an exam. Our exam system, our schooling system has almost become a system of design to maximise the A's and B's that you can get out to kids on exam day. If instead of doing that, you take a measure, for instance, how numerate are young adults? Adults aged around 20, 21. And you give them a basic test of mathematics and compare those internationally. For the best of 25, 30 countries in the world, according to the OECD, we rank about third to the bottom. We are one of the least numerate countries in the world now. USA is actually ranked at the bottom, and at the top is Finland and Japan and China, in some ways, although that's the hot housing of kids in particular cities who are actually allowed to be in those cities. So the suggestion is that unequal societies, people actually learn worse. They don't do as well at actually learning properly. Learning properly is learning mathematics so that when you're asked to do mathematical things later in life, you're able to do that. It is not getting an A at GCSE maths. It is not getting an A at A-level maths necessarily. It's actually getting an understanding, or if you want to get really excited about it, the love of mathematics. So that when your 13 or 14-year-old child asks you to help them with your homework, you can actually do that. And a number of middle-class people in this country who cannot help their children with things as simple as just trying to get a B or an A at GCSE is kind of telling of our whole society. We can see it in a worst way in the States. One way to understand how unusual this country is compared to the rest of Europe is to look at the States, which we tend to see as unusual and to see as odd. And often young people in the States will talk about their GPA scores and what a high number they've got and so on. But they won't necessarily have read that much or be able to hold up their own in a master's course in this university where there are people from all over the world. Because a lot has been spent telling them how clever they are rather than actually giving them an environment in which they can learn more equally and more freely. The European country which ends up with the best exam results is Finland. It's a country in which most children go to a local school. The schools are very similar, the teachers are high paid, and they're not examined constantly on whether their children are jumping over various hoops or not. But that's just the first one. It's our educational system. One thing that's happened in this country as we've become more unequal is we've spent more and more money on a small number of children. We have an incredibly segregated education system across the board in this city. This city may be the most remarkable city in the UK for education. Because if you know it, you're going along the they're all academies now, which in the end is the kind of thing that can only happen in an unequal country. If you compare the exam results of the schools, you'll find the bottom school in Oxford is in the top of the bottom 25 secondaries in the country. You're then going linearly up with a little bit of aggro in between, and then off to the 28% of kids in this city, or possibly 40% at any one time who go private. And then we have a hierarchy of private schools in this city. So we have four times more children going private in Oxford than go private nationally. And overall, about a quarter of our spending on secondary education is just on those 7% of children nationally. There are countries in the OECD who spend more per head on the children who are doing slower at school than on the children who are doing better. And in those countries, children do better overall. We do the opposite. We spend most per head on a small set of children whose defining characteristic is their parents can afford the school fees. It's just not a particularly efficient way of educating a population. Anyway, I've said five things. I must get off education. The second is poverty, or looking at poverty. It becomes much easier to get a grasp of why the trends in poverty have occurred as they have when you begin to link it to inequality. And it's actually almost by definition, because the European definition of poverty is you're on half or 60% of median income. So inequalities rise and more people will be below 60% of median income. It's a product of rising inequalities. Most recently, as we've hit new heights of inequality in this country, we've seen absolute rises in poverty again, something we thought had disappeared by 2007. So more people actually having to go to soup kitchens, in effect. And again, if you look at the propensity of that across the world, you'll find that they had soup kitchens back again earlier in the USA than they had here. I'd skip off poverty and just talk about work. If you're trying to understand things like employment. Why do we no longer employ so many young people? Why were about 1 in 3, 1 in 4 new jobs last year in estate agents? It wasn't just a housing boom. Those were the jobs that were available. 2 years before, it was waiting on tables, was the biggest increase in jobs for young people in the country. We have 25 million people not employed across Europe who are under 25. We have at least 500,000 young people in this country who are not officially unemployed, but mum and dad are giving them £10 a day so they don't have to claim job seekers allowance and they can pretend that they're doing their startup company or something. Why can't we employ this large number of highly skilled young people? Is it because we don't have enough money to pay them? you then look at the salary bill. And you look at the salary bill and you see we've never spent more on people in employment. We've never actually had salaries that in aggregate have been this high. But what we've done is we've more than doubled the salaries of those in the top 10th. They're paid more than twice as much in real terms as they were around about 1980. And that's very, very expensive because these already were the best off people in the country around about then. And if you employ more people on these very high salaries, you have less money overall, so you can't employ other people. If you're my age, or most of your ages, and you're making these kind of decisions, the jobs you look after are yours. And what you don't worry about is hiring more younger people. So you see fewer younger people working in universities. You might say, oh, this is easy, you could solve it, stop paying your professors so much. If you don't pay the professors this much, they won't come to Oxford because they won't be able to buy themselves a little house. So you're forced to pay the professors this much, and then you can't employ the teaching assistants who would actually make things much more fun for the undergraduates because you're having to pay the people at the top more. And why are the house prices so high? A little bit of it is the pressure to move into the city, but a lot of it is that you've paid people at the top so much more that they can afford to pay more for their housing, and then they compete more to buy houses in certain areas, and they force the house prices up. And why are they competing to live in certain areas? Well, it's because they're worrying about the schools now, in a way they never used to worry about the schools because we had no school league tables when I was young. And education begins to matter more. And it begins to matter more, and you have to pay for your child to go to a private school because your children have to get A's and A stars because they don't not only have to get into university, they have to get into the right university then to get the right job because they have to get in to the top 10% because society is pulling apart. And the idea that your children could do an average job becomes more and more of a nightmare for many upper middle class families. And if you look at the very top, I won't dwell too much on the very top, but there's more inequality within the top 1% than there is within the other 99%. And that's where you see the most angst and people making some of the hardest decisions and having the most curtailed opportunities. Because there are not many jobs that pay over 160,000 a year. So you can't become a doctor or a school teacher or be an artist. If you're from one of those families at the very top, you really are looking at law or finance. From the age of 14, you know you're looking at law and finance. And I don't think this is a particularly great way to be. Two more issues and then I promise to stop. Housing. Housing begins to go terribly, terribly wrong as inequality increases. Housing is a very interesting good because our individual purchase and use of housing uses up other people's potential use of housing. It has a more obvious and direct effect than many other purchases. There would be no problem if all the super rich wanted to buy fine art. It really isn't that problematic. You might get upset if they don't display it and if you particularly like fine art, but it's not that hard to produce more art. You can tell I'm not an artist. But the people of the world are not going to be particularly badly affected by losing their access to art. But when it comes to housing, there is a problem. This city makes it particularly easy to demonstrate that. We have 40,000 people driving in every day to try to get into the jobs of the city. The city is now completely unaffordable. If you are extremely well paid and not particularly snobby about having to live in North Oxford, you can do it. But that's what you need. If you're an associate professor and not at a rich college, you're renting. You're not buying. And God forbid, if you tell the landlord that you've got a child, you're not renting in Jericho because the landlords don't need to let you. That's the situation it's got to in Oxford. This is not like it was in Oxford in the 1970s. Everybody remembers problems in housing. It is now extreme. 2/3 of house sales in London, houses and flats, last 2 years have been going to landlords. Because as inequality increases, one way people at the top can maintain their position is by buying property and renting it out to increase their income. Private landlords are the most inefficient users of housing in the country. They tend to have the housing empty the most, or least well used, because they're only interested in who can pay the rent, not in how many people are actually fitting in that house. Like I said, If you're a young lecturer of children, they'll turn you down because they don't want kids in their flat or their house. They'd rather have fewer people doing less damage to the house than more people. And so housing becomes more and more precarious and trickier to get into. House prices rise, you get a bubble, and it's fueled by inequality. At the very top in London, as this country's become more unequal, it's not just that more people at the very top have become richer, we've also become a magnet that's drawn in people with enormous amount of money into the country, which makes some of these problems more difficult. In Oxford, you can see it with a few Russians and a few Formula One drivers and a few Chinese buying up some of the houses and actually making communities in the very richest part of this city less of a community at the extreme. And finally, health. Health was the weakest relationship in the spirit level. This is the relationship in which life expectancy tends to be lower in more unequal rich countries and highest in the most equal. So it's highest in Japan. Japan was one of the most unequal countries in the world in the 1920s and 30s. It was a feudal system ruled by a small aristocracy. The Americans changed all that, not because they wished to do a wonderful natural experiment to see what happens if you make everybody incredibly equal, but because the Americans after the war were petrified there'd be a revolution in Japan, a communist revolution in Japan. So to prevent a communist revolution in Japan, they took the land and distributed it as evenly as they could across the population and created a 90% middle class in Japan. The end result of that is you have a country with the highest life expectancy and the lowest crime rates in the world. Contrast that with the United States of America. It's a country with the highest infant mortality rates in the rich world and rising in places. Country which has infant mortality rates which Oxford had when I was born. That's how far back you have to go to find an equivalent. And with life expectancy moving up extremely slowly or even falling for some groups. But it's the weakest of relationships. If you're trying to think, what is the mechanism? What could it be? Lots of mechanisms are put forward for this. One small one, which I quite like, is just thinking about medics. Think about GPs. In a more equal country, it is far easier to get your doctors to distribute themselves across the country and be available everywhere because they don't have any worry about living anywhere because everywhere is very similar. Try to get young doctors in this country to go and work in Grimsby or in Hull or in the Welsh Valleys, and it's extremely difficult to do. It even got to the point in Oxford, and this was quite amazing, in the 1990s when you could advertise a post as a GP in Cowley or Blackbird Leys and only get two applicants. And yeah, this was Oxford. Why don't doctors want to work in Cowley and Blackbird Leys? Because this is an incredibly unequal country and medics tend to come from a social strata where they're not used to living and working in such areas. They all tend to want to live in areas which are a bit like the areas they grew up in. And so we end up with an inverse care law in the NHS with fewer medical staff in the areas with more illness. Now, if you think medical staff do anything to make health better, then that's a problem. But the much more extreme one than life expectancy is mental illness. Rates of mental illness appear to be highest in the most unequal countries. When they're surveyed by WHO surveys, one in four people in the United States apparently suffer from depression or anxiety or a condition related to that at a clinical level. It's lowest in the most equal countries. It is high amongst the rich. And if you want a direct measure of this, you simply look at sales of Prozac and where they are highest and where they are lowest. So people are medicating themselves in unequal places to cope with this. There's five examples. The final thing worth saying before you ask questions is to talk about the future. The future can look very bad. It can look very depressing unless you begin to look at these numbers and say, well, this really isn't sustainable. There is nobody out there who will be able to buy these houses at these house prices in 20 years' time. There is no way in which you can get to a situation where even the majority of Oxford undergraduates are going to have to go into occupations where they see their standards of living falling. I mean, you may be able to fool all of Oxford undergraduates as well as the majority of your graduates in the country, but this looks very unlikely. So we're in an unsustainable period at the moment it is extremely likely, just from regression to the mean, that things are going to become more equal. They may well become more equal and poorer in the future, but I wouldn't be pessimistic about it unless we sleepwalk into it and we, like that frog in the kettle that's slowly heated up to the point it dies, we simply don't notice how unusual this has got and we don't begin to complain more about it. But now's the time to be looking at inequality. It is interesting, it is exciting, and it affects so many other issues that you never thought were affected by it. Thank you very much.